Ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate the honor of addressing you this morning. Certainly my presentation will be prosaic in the extreme after what Roger has just said, because I have been asked to address rather a simple question. What is the relation between justice and the Constitution of the United States? And to that question, I must give a relatively simple answer, but an answer I believe that is firmly grounded in history. The Constitution is an instrument of justice, not its source. The Constitution did not, and does not today, correctly interpreted, purport to create new principles of justice, or to serve as some sort of mechanism or black box out of which legislators or jurists can grind out principles of justice to fit the changing circumstances of political caprice. Rather, the Constitution attempted, and hopefully today should be applied still, to bring to bear on the practical affairs of government in a free society principles of justice that pre-existed the ratification of the Constitution. Seems to me that there is no serious historical argument that can be made that these pre-constitutional principles of justice, the so-called founding fathers, derived from natural law. Again, it is not my place here today to delve into the extremely difficult questions that arise in the interpretation or definition of natural law or its many variants. I suppose, though, that we can say that the founders, in their vast majority, believed that natural law was a doctrine that said, in essence, that rights exist as aspects of reality in and of themselves, that rights find their ultimate source in the structure of the natural world, and that rights belong to individual men as part of men's intrinsic characters. Fortunately, again, I do not have to defend the proposition that natural law makes sense, that the founders were wise or unwise in believing in natural law, that it was expeditious on their part, in any immediate or ultimate sense, to use natural law as the basis for the constitutional structure that they designed. It's enough for my purpose to inquire as to what history teaches, and then to leave judgments on history to others. But again, it seems to me that history is quite clear on this point. The founders believed, in the vast majority, that natural law and natural rights not only existed, but that they stated moral limits to the assertions of political power in society. That it was the duty of government to enunciate, to codify, and to enforce natural rights through positive law. And that the Constitution would serve to confine the actions of government to this sphere. But let's consider those three elements. First, the fundamental one, I believe, natural rights as a check or limitation on political power. It's not unfair, I believe, to say that the founders' socio-political presuppositions were somewhat pessimistic. But then you know the definition of a pessimist is an optimist who knows the facts. They had a rather realistic appreciation of human weaknesses and human fallibility. In their estimation, history was pretty much the chronicle of the depravity of human nature. And if it taught one thing, it was that passion causes men, especially men invested with political power, to disregard the general welfare of society. Particularly threatening to the society that the founders desired was what so many of them called the love of power. Here we come back to what the founders believed nature had done. It was their view that nature had implanted in men a fondness for power as a characteristic of the human animal. And just as the very nature of power was to be ever encroaching, So human nature never parted from power. Their constant experience had taught them that every man invested with power is apt, at least, to abuse it and to carry his authority as far as it would go or as far as he could take it. And therefore they concluded that no man ought to be trusted with what no man was equal to. Yet on the other hand, they believed that political power was necessary to the preservation of individual liberty. They saw a conflict between power and liberty that emerged in a dichotomy between the governors and the governed. Power would adhere, and necessarily so, in government and in those people who control it, whereas liberty necessarily adheres in society generally. Liberty is not the concern of those invested with power as much as it is the peculiar possession of society. The governors will always tend to seek to acquire and exploit power, whereas society seeks to preserve and enjoy liberty under the protection of power, but not under its direction. Power and liberty, then, as far as the founders saw them, exist in an uneasy balance in which one constantly threatens to extinguish the other. The practical problem was how to arrange political institutions based upon power and yet consistent with liberty. "It may be a reflection on human nature," wrote Madison in the Federalist Papers, "that such devices should be necessary to control the abuses of government. But what is government itself but the greatest of all reflections on human nature? If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external or internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. A dependency on the people, no doubt, is the primary control on the government, but experience has taught mankind the necessity of auxiliary precautions." These precautions took into account four basic principles. First, the idea that when the dangers that might arise from the abuse of a power are greater than the benefits that may arise from its use, the power should be withheld from government. Secondly, that the control of governmental authority should not depend upon the self-restraint or goodwill of the governors themselves, or upon the probable virtue of the people's representatives, but instead ought to have such institutional checks and limitations as to prevent bad men from abusing it. It ought to be granted on the supposition that men will be bad, because that may eventually come to pass. Thirdly, the founders recognized that democracy offers as many opportunities for the corrupting influences of power as any other system of government. And fourthly, whatever system of government prevailed, they desired to see natural law and natural rights circumscribing and defining its power. Natural law underlay the founders' conceptions in four basic ways. First, it provided moral standards to govern private conduct. Secondly, it provided ethical criteria to which positive law should conform. Under their view, there was no dichotomy then in the final analysis between morality and law. No double standard would insulate political activity from moral criticism. Moral criticism, in fact, would become part of the political process. Thirdly, natural law would establish limits beyond which governments acted at the peril of resistance or perhaps revolution. In natural law, the founders saw a moral justification or arguably extra-legal acts of people against governments that oppressed them. And finally, natural law was the source of natural or individual rights, rights that were antecedent to and of necessity superior to government. In sum, for the founders, natural rights were the means to subordinate to morality the positive law that governments would enact. All men, ran a rather typical statement of one of the founders' theories of law and politics, all men are by nature free and independent and have certain rights of which, when they enter into society, they cannot by any compact deprive or divest their posterity. By natural rights, the founders meant rights that belong to individuals simply because of their humanity, and that law should recognize for that reason alone. These rights were natural because they were derived from the plan of nature and of nature's God, as the Declaration of Independence informs us. They were essential because they were necessary to the existence of free men in a free society. They were absolute because they adhered in individuals without regard to the commands or prohibitions of government. And they were unalienable because they constituted an element of each man's individual character itself. Natural rights, of course, differed from civil or political rights because they were antecedent to the peculiar laws of a particular society or a particular government. They came with individuals into society and were the primary justification for government itself. Now, of course, the founders were well aware that individuals are not equal in their various talents, ultimately then in the prestige, the income, the wealth, or the social position that they attain. And they certainly did not conceive of any natural right to equality in respect of these things that the government should enforce. But they did have a very important view of equality. It was the equality that Locke defined, the equality which all men are in respect of jurisdiction or dominion one over another, being that equal right that every man hath to his natural freedom without being subjected to the will or authority of any other man. To the founders, equality in this sense was the fundamental principle of politics. Property and liberty were also central principles of this political theory. That men have a natural right to the fruits of their labors as private property, free from the predation of other men in private station or acting under color of governmental authority, was rather a commonplace among 18th century Americans. In his extremely influential second treatise, Locke had already used the term property to include whatever of value a man has, including his liberty. I think, though, more correctly, the founders saw property as an aspect of liberty. Now, these conceptions of liberty, property, and equality correlated very nicely. Equality and liberty, the freedom of each individual from the arbitrary wills of other men, government could at least make steps to attain. Indeed, in a fundamental sense, liberty could only exist when all members of society possessed it equally. Property, though, was the product of liberty exercised by individuals who are dissimilar in talent, in intelligence, or in the peculiar circumstances of their lives. And therefore, equality in property was likely impossible, unless, of course, government denied equality in liberty in disregard of the very reason for its existence. The founders, in short, foresaw, as a consequence of their natural law views, a society in which men would earn different incomes, enjoy different amounts of wealth, occupy different social positions, yet remain equal in the one thing that properly concerns government, their natural freedom. Which brings us to the role of government as the guarantor of natural rights. The founders presumed that only the protection of natural rights justifies government in the final analysis. Relying on Locke's principle that the great and chief end of men's uniting into commonwealths and putting themselves under government is the preservation of their property, the founders constantly talked of government and of liberty, the object of government. To them, government had no purpose except to protect the liberty, security, and property of those individuals who instituted it and live under it. Indeed, the very allegiance of a citizen to his government was predicated upon, a consequence of, the protection that that government would give to the citizen's natural rights. In short, the goal of the framers was what Locke called freedom of men under government, to have a standing rule to live by, common to everyone in that society, a liberty to follow my own will in all things where the rule prescribes not, and not to be subject to the inconstant, unknown, arbitrary will of another man. course, the founders did not assume that a government fit for free men would spontaneously arise from the people's will without a very carefully wrought structure based on the principles of natural law. The people, too, had to accept that the minority have indisputable and inalienable rights. The majority are not everything, and the minority nothing. Limitations upon the popular will, the founders embodied the principle that government is justifiable only insofar as its powers reflect what reasoning men would freely choose and compact among themselves to give it. Consent was the legitimating principle of government, and the social compact was the mechanism of popular consent. Consent explained why men should submit to governmental compulsion. It explained how positive laws could legitimately control them. It explained how they could remain free while accepting political institutions that in fact restrict their actions, take their goods, and sometimes even conscript their lives for the general welfare. For the founders, the principle was quite simple and straightforward. Men obey government in exchange for protection of their natural rights. Thus, to the founders, natural liberty and government were mutually complementary. The protection of liberty was the reason for government, and government was the guarantor of liberty. To say that one could possibly be inconsistent with the other was on its face self-contradictory and absurd. Perhaps nothing, then, was more obvious to the founders than that for people to agree to an unlimited government over their liberty and property was ridiculous. A wise people, the founders urged, should suspect governments and governors. Of course, the American people as a whole were sovereign, but this description didn't imply unlimited power, because the founders knew that popular sovereignty itself derives from the natural law postulate that individuals may choose their own governing institutions because they may defend themselves against aggression. Governmental power, then, is inherently limited because natural law recognizes only defensive powers in individual men from whose voluntary consent governments arise. So in sum, the founders saw government as a repository of powers permanently limited by the principles of natural law that the governors may exercise solely to protect each individual's enjoyment of his liberties within a community of citizens equal before the law. Which brings us now to the instrumental role of the Constitution. To define the proper sphere of governmental activity according to the principles of natural law, I will not say is easy, but it seems to me that it certainly is easier as an intellectual task than the practical one of confining the operations of government to that sphere, whatever it may be. To achieve this end, the founders employed a written constitution. Now here, perhaps really for the first time, they parted with British tradition. As we're all aware, the unwritten British Constitution then, as I suppose still today, embodied only those principles that the nation's institutions and development had implied. Under this conception of a constitution, though, a governmental act that was contrary to custom was not an exercise of power without right. It was simply an act of bad government. In their struggle with Parliament, however, the founders learned to rely on principles of justice rather than mere legal institutions and traditions. They saw the paradox in expecting a constitution that embodied acts of a legislature to limit the power of the legislature. And they realized the necessity to separate principles of law from acts of government and the necessity to conceive of those principles as bounds beyond which the government could not act. Experience taught them the difference between a constitution and a government. A constitution is an act not of the government, but of the people creating the government. And its violation is not simply an error of judgment, but an affront to popular right. The constitution antecedes the government it defines, establishes the authority the people have committed to the governors, and its very existence of necessity voids any acts of the government outside the grants of power. Well, to achieve this rather compendious goal, the founders provided the Constitution with three basic types of provisions defining or limiting governmental authority. First, the Constitution defines the purposes of government. Second, It prescribes a framework of government and circumscribes the authority of the various branches and levels of that government. And third, it guarantees to individuals certain named and other unenumerated liberties. The preamble, for instance, describes the purposes of the people of the United States in ordaining the Constitution in terms of the very ends for which Locke had earlier argued that men form political societies in the first place: to defend themselves against criminals, against domestic and foreign enemies, to advance the common good by legislation that preserves the members of society in their lives and possessions, to guarantee the natural freedom of all men who follow the rule of reason, to establish justice, to promote the general welfare, to secure the blessings of liberty. These are three of the essential purposes of the Constitution. The founders knew, however, that the government could not be left free to declare whatever it did as in service of these ends. Under the founders' plan and interpretation, there could never be what is popularly called today a living constitution, the fundamental principles of which change coloration, chameleon-like, with the political caprices of the day. Instead, they limited the actions of government by explicit reference to precepts of natural law: justice, the general welfare, the blessings of liberty, enunciate in and of themselves a law higher than what governments enact. They negate the concept of arbitrary sovereignty, and they affirm that all men have certain unalienable rights, to secure which they institute governments in the first place. Going to the body of the Constitution, we can see in the description of the framework of government, the founders very carefully attempted to circumscribe the authority of each level and branch. Take some examples. Article 1, Section 9, Clause 8, and Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1, deny the national and the state governments any power to grant titles of nobility. In this very simple prohibition, the Constitution eradicated even the possibility that a stultifying feudalism might affect American life, establishing instead a republican society in which all men, at least in theory, were equal citizens before the law. Again, Article 1, Section 9, Clause 3, and Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1, prohibit the national and state governments from enacting bills of attainder or ex post facto laws. At one stroke, then, the Constitution denied legislatures the authority to sit as judges, establishing instead judicial supremacy over the adjudication of men's rights. And again, Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1, precludes the state governments from emitting bills of credit or making anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. And Article 1, Section 8, Clause 5 grants the national government only the limited power to coin money. Through these clauses, the Constitution eliminated fiat money from the nation's commerce, establishing instead a system of economic justice based upon gold and silver as a legal tender. Finally, the various amendments to the Constitution refer to individual rights reserved against governmental encroachment. Of course, some of these are explicitly named: freedom of speech or of the press, the right to keep and bear arms, the right to be secure against unreasonable searches and seizures, the right to a speedy trial by an impartial jury, so forth and so on. Others are unenumerated. But all of these references presume that individuals owe nothing to governments, nothing to written constitutions, or nothing to the will of the people for the recognition of those rights. They presume, rather, that a government, a constitution, or a society that refuses or neglects to recognize the rights is therefore itself defective and unjust, and that such a deficiency in injustice permits those aggrieved to seek redress by appeal to principles that transcend positive law and by recourse to actions that perhaps are extra legal in character. Such is the constitutional structure that the founders built. As a structure, it has survived more than two centuries of legal, social, and economic conflict. But whether it still serves as the instrument of justice the founders designed it to be, you must judge for yourself. Thank you.